From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! The pro-Syrian Prime Minister of Lebanon steps down as tens of thousands of people take to the streets to demand Syria withdraw troops. We go to Beirut for a report.
Is Lebanon undergoing a velvet revolution? It remains to be seen, but what is certain is that the Lebanese have united in large numbers for the first time to peacefully demand an end to Syrian interference in Lebanon.
Then we go to Haiti, where police open fire on protesters calling for the return of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We continue our coverage of detainee abuse, not in Abu Ghraib, but right here in Brooklyn, New York.
In both cases, we saw secret detention, and behind that cloak of secrecy, abuses took place and they went unchecked.
And we take a look at why two employees are blowing the whistle on Custer Battles.
Custer Battles is a brand new private security company that was paid millions of dollars by the Iraqi government and is now charged with overcharging the government by 250% in costs.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, the Syrian-backed prime minister has resigned along with the entire government. The surprise move came Monday as tens of thousands of Lebanese protesters took to the streets of Beirut calling for Syria to end its occupation of Lebanon. Huge celebrations continued into the night in Beirut. Protesters say they'll continue holding demonstrations until Syria withdraws its 15,000 troops from Lebanese soil. We'll go to Beirut in a few minutes. Meanwhile, pressure continues to mount on Syria from both the U.S. and Israel. Syrian President Bashar Assad told the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, quote, "The language used by the White House indicates a campaign similar to the one that preceded the attack on Iraq." Meanwhile, in Washington, Republican Congressman Sam Johnson of Texas has recommended to President Bush that the U.S. consider attacking Syria with nuclear weapons. Johnson recently told a church gathering, quote, "Syria is the problem. Syria is where those weapons of mass destruction are, in my view. You know, I can fly an F-15, put two nukes on them, and I'll make one pass. We won't have to worry about Syria anymore," he said. In Iraq, the death toll from Monday's massive suicide car bombing in Hilla has risen to 125, making it the deadliest bombing carried out by the Iraqi resistance since the war began. In other Iraq news, a video has been broadcast of the kidnapped French reporter pleading for her life. Florence Abinas, a correspondent for the French newspaper Libération, has been missing since January. Human Rights Watch is criticizing a U.S. plan to deploy a new system of remote-controlled anti-personnel mines in Iraq called the Matrix. The group says the Pentagon has failed to answer crucial questions about the potential harms the mines could pose to innocent civilians. Meanwhile, the human rights lawyers are planning to file a lawsuit in federal court today against Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld on behalf of eight men who say they were tortured by U.S. forces in custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. The suit is being filed jointly by the American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights First. The detainees were reportedly subjected to torture and other cruel and degrading treatment, including severe and repeated beatings, cutting with knives, sexual humiliation and assault, mock executions, and death threats. In news from Britain, the London Telegraph is reporting it's obtained evidence that as many as 50 British soldiers are now facing prosecution for murder, assault, and other offenses committed in Iraq. Publicly, the British military has only admitted that 14 soldiers face such charges. But documents seen by the Telegraph show the military is investigating 137 incidents, including over 60 that involve the deaths of Iraqis. Here at home, a federal judge has ordered that the Bush administration can no longer keep U.S. citizen Jose Padilla in jail if he is not charged with a crime. Padilla's been in prison for more than 2.5 years as a so-called enemy combatant. He's never been charged with a crime, has never appeared in a courtroom to challenge his detention. Judge Henry Floyd ruled, quote, "The court finds that the president has no power, neither express nor implied, neither constitutional nor statutory, to hold petitioner as an enemy combatant." Floyd is a federal judge based in South Carolina. He was appointed by President Bush 2 years ago. The Justice Department has announced it will appeal the decision. The government alleges Padilla wanted to carry out a dirty bomb attack inside the United States. In Israel, the country's Supreme Court has ordered the Israeli military to reopen its investigation into the shooting of U.S. peace activist Brian Avery. Avery was shot in the West Bank town of Jenin nearly 2 years ago. The shooting shattered his jaw and his nose, forcing him to undergo a series of facial reconstruction surgeries. Witnesses said an Israeli armored personnel carrier opened fire on Avery, but Israel's denied being behind the shooting. Avery returned to Israel last week for the first time since the shooting to attend the Supreme Court proceeding. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear his conversation with Democracy Now! When he arrived in Israel. In other news from Israel, the head of Israel's intelligence agency told cabinet ministers on Sunday that the chances Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of being assassinated by hardline Israelis is rapidly increasing because of his support of removing settlements in Gaza. Sharon's cabinet has approved the formation of a special justice ministry unit to deal with those suspected of carrying out planned or actual illegal activity. In other news on Israel, the World Council of Churches has called on member churches to sell off investments in companies profiting from the Israeli control of the West Bank and Gaza. The council is the main global body uniting non-Catholic Christians and represents up to 500 million Christians in over 120 countries. The council criticized Israel for demolishing Palestinian homes, building settlements on occupied land, and constructing a 400-mile separation wall in the West Bank. Last year, the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly issued a similar call for divestment from Israel. In Haiti, at least three supporters of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide were shot dead Monday by police during a march commemorating the first anniversary of the coup in Haiti. Dozens of protesters were also hurt. One demonstrator said, quote, "The police opened fire on a peaceful march with the UN blue helmets looking on." We'll go to a report from Haiti later in the program. The Financial Times is reporting Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz has emerged as a leading candidate to become the next president of the World Bank to replace James Wolfensohn. Wolfowitz was a chief architect of the Iraq invasion as one of the leading conservative voices inside the Bush administration. Also being considered is Randall Tobias, former head of the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly. At the United Nations, the Bush administration insisted Monday that the right to abortion should not be considered a fundamental human right. The administration made the assertion during a major gathering in New York of the UN Commission on the Status of Women. Over 6,000 advocates of women's rights are meeting in New York over the next 2 weeks to review progress of the 1995 Beijing Conference on Women. In Uruguay, Tabar Vasquez is being sworn in today to become the country's first ever left-wing president. Attending the celebration will be Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, Brazilian President Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, Evo Morales of Bolivia, and representatives of the Cuban government. In Chicago, a federal judge who was once targeted for death by a white supremacist leader found her mother and husband dead inside her home when she returned on Monday evening. Last year, white supremacist Matthew Hale was found guilty on charges he tried to arrange the murder of the judge, Joan Humphrey Lufkow. The judge had earlier ordered Hale's group to stop using the name World Church of the Creator, which belonged to another religious group with no ties to Hale. and in Vermont. 50 town meetings will be voting tonight on a resolution to call on President Bush to withdraw troops from Iraq and to urge the state's elected leaders to reconsider the use of Vermont's National Guard in the war.
Past the ivy-covered windows of the Angel, down Athenaeum Lane, to the cathedral. Through the churchyard I wandered, sat for a spell there, and I pondered my back to the gate. My back to the gates. My back to the gates of the garden. Fugitive fathers, sickly infants, decent mothers, runaways, and suicidal lovers. Assorted boxes of ordinary bones, of aborted plans and sudden shattered hopes in unlucky roads, in unhappy roads.
Gates of the Garden by Nick Cave here on this very snowy day in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In an unexpected move, Lebanese Prime Minister Omar Karami announced his resignation in front of the country's parliament on Monday, effectively terminating the rule of the current Syrian-backed government. The announcement was aired live on television and greeted with cheers from tens of thousands of Lebanese protesters gathered outside the parliament building in defiance of a government ban on demonstrations. They waved Lebanese flags, demanded that Syria remove its 15,000 troops from the country. Protesters left in the early hours of Tuesday, only for a few hundred to return hours later, vowing to keep up their street protests until Syria withdraws its forces. While the protests have been widespread, Shiite Muslims, who form Lebanon's largest community, have mainly stayed away from the anti-Syrian rallies. The resignation of the cabinet came 2 weeks after the killing of the former Lebanese prime minister, Rafik Hariri. Both Karami's government and the Syrian government have been accused of involvement in Hariri's assassination, charges they deny. In his announcement, Karami said, quote, "I'm keen the government will not be a hurdle in front of those who want the good for this country. I declare the resignation of the government that I had the honor to head. May God preserve Lebanon." His announcement came as an opposition-sponsored motion of no confidence in the government was being debated in parliament. The government will stay on as caretakers while President Emir Lahoud consults on a new administration. The immediate reaction from Syria, which backs the Lebanese government, was noncommittal, saying only that it was, quote, an internal affair for Lebanon. Meanwhile, the White House hailed the move as the step towards democracy. This is White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan.
We are closely watching developments with great interest. The resignation of the Karami government represents an opportunity for the Lebanese people to have a new government that is truly representative of their country's diversity. The new government will have the responsibility of implementing free and fair elections that the Lebanese people have clearly demonstrated they desire. We believe the process of a new government should proceed in accordance with the Lebanese constitution and should be free of all foreign interference. It is time for Syria to fully comply with United Nations Security Council Resolution 1559. That means Syrian military forces and intelligence personnel need to leave the country. That will help ensure that elections are free and fair.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. After Karami's announcement, the Daily Star newspaper wrote in an editorial, quote, "Electricity is in the air. Beirut is a sea of excitement and activity and turmoil. The word revolution is on many lips. We go now to Beirut, to freelance reporter Kate Seely. Kate, first, can you tell us where you are?
Well, Amy, I live in Jemaisi. It's a neighborhood very close to Martyrs Square, where Hariri was buried, and the site of the demonstrations and protests that have been taking place for the last 2 weeks. So I'm sort of living right in the middle of it.
Can you talk about the latest developments, the resignation of the prime minister and the response?
Well, his resignation was met with jubilation throughout most of the country last night. There had been tens of thousands of people gathered in Martyrs Square during the course of yesterday's parliamentary debate, which had been called to demand a fair investigation into the Hariri assassination and also to demand the resignation of Omar Karami. Thousands had come out to support the opposition politicians' demands. And at the end of the session, when Karami made the surprise announcement, as you mentioned, thousands of people cheered wildly and began to party all night long in the streets of Beirut, celebrating what many saw as a victory for the Lebanese people. For many Lebanese, this was the first time that they felt their voice had really been heard, and it was a very exciting and giddy feeling for most here.
I know that the wife of Hariri did not allow the prime minister to attend her husband's funeral. What evidence is there that he or Syria was involved?
There is no evidence, but the feeling here is that a blast of such magnitude could not have been masterminded without the knowledge of the Syrian intelligence and the Lebanese intelligence, who are closely aligned with the Syrians. This was a 300 or 700-pound bomb that was possibly planted under the road. The sense is that this could not have been the work of a rogue group. There's also a feeling here that the Syrians have had a long history of assassinating Lebanese politicians who don't agree with their policies or who don't kowtow. And the former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri had been making, there had been signs in the weeks leading up to his assassination that he was turning toward the Lebanese opposition, which had been calling for Syria's withdrawal. Many people feel that the Syrians just couldn't stomach the fact that somebody with his influence, his power, his connections, and his weight as a Sunni Muslim would join the opposition better to get rid of him. So, of course, this is all speculation, but it's based, as I said, on a long history of Syrian interference in Lebanese political affairs.
We're talking with Kate Seely, freelance reporter in Beirut, about the latest news, the resignation of the prime minister of Lebanon. What happens right now?
Well, next, the president, President Lahoud, must form an interim government. So he will hold consultations with members of parliament to form that interim government. Of course, that interim government is key to the future of Lebanon. And what's happening behind closed doors right now as we speak is that members of Lebanon's political opposition are meeting to determine what kind of interim government they want to see and what role they will play in influencing Lahoud and the Lebanese parliament's decision-making vis-a-vis this interim government. I was just at a meeting of Christian opposition members. They, of course, are calling for a neutral, independent interim government, one that can be trusted to prepare for parliamentary elections this spring, either in April or May. There are debates going on as to who should be the next prime minister of Lebanon. Some would like to see Hariri's sister, Bahia Hariri, herself a member of parliament, as the first Arab female prime minister. Others are naming other well-known Sunni politicians as possible candidates. So we're still in the early days. It remains to be seen what kind of interim government will be formed, but there will be a lot of haggling, I would imagine, in the next few days.
Kate Seeley, thanks very much for joining us, reporting from Beirut, Lebanon. This is Democracy Now! In a minute, we'll go to Haiti, where police opened fire on a pro-Aristide demonstration on the first anniversary of the coup. Stay with us. Hey, Sanyo, Jean Rebel here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of the anniversary of the coup in Haiti, which was carried out 1 year ago this week, in a moment we will go to Port-au-Prince, where police opened fire on a group of peaceful demonstrators who are calling for the return of President Aristide. But first, we return to President Aristide himself. For months, he's been living in exile in South Africa and has maintained a very low profile. But a few days before the anniversary of the coup, Aristide granted a rare interview with the famed Afro-French journalist Claude Rubé. Aristide said that he remains president of Haiti.
Je suis le président de la République d'Haïti, même si je ne suis pas en Haïti. Je termine mon mandat.
I am the president of Haiti, Aristide says, even if I am not in Haiti. I finish my term. I want to return to my country before time goes by on the basis of a negotiated agreement or a dialogue so that free, honest, and democratic elections could be held, as stated by the Constitution. Again, those are the words of President Aristide. He also names two high-level French emissaries who says he threatened him, and they threatened him in the days before his ouster, to either resign or be killed. He identifies them as Véronique de Villepin, the sister of the French foreign minister Dominique de Villepin, and the French foreign minister's appointee, Régis Debray. Aristide maintains he was overthrown, what he called a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Meanwhile, in Haiti, police opened fire on thousands of demonstrators who marched through the Bel Air neighborhood of Port-au-Prince Monday to mark the anniversary of the coup. Chanting Aristide for life, the thousands of protesters marched peacefully to demand Aristide's return. As the demonstrators rounded a corner at a Bel Air intersection, police opened fire, killing as many as three people. In response, Democratic Congressmember Maxine Waters of California sent a letter to the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, expressing, quote, shock and outrage, and urging an investigation into the attack. We go now to Port-au-Prince to speak with Bill Quigley. He's there as a volunteer attorney with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He was at the march yesterday when police opened fire. Bill Quigley, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. What happened?
We had been marching with people through the neighborhood, and it was a really joyous occasion, people singing and dancing and jumping and shouting and holding up homemade signs and chanting, "Bring back Aristide." And there was a lot of international media there. There were UN troops that were every couple of blocks, and it looked like it was going to be a very peaceful demonstration and very safe. And then all of a sudden, about 30 minutes into the demonstration, as thousands of people were coming down this street, there was just a series of booms from the police, and people scattered and screamed. There were people down in the street. They showed pictures on the television last night of somebody who had the back half of their head blown off. There's other people who were beaten by the police, but it was just shot after shot after shot, and these booms just echoed through the streets as children were screaming and crying, people diving for cover and running away. And it wasn't actually till a lot of the UN troops came in that people felt even safe enough to be able to venture back to the street to be able to try to escape the neighborhood. It was a horrifying and totally unprovoked massacre. People didn't have, they had no guns, no bats, no pipes, no rocks, no anything. They were holding up political signs and dancing. There was a band. It was just a shocking display of attempt to repress human rights and democracy.
Bill Quigley, what about the UN, the, as they call them, the Blue Helmets? What were they doing?
Well, they really, before all this started, they were just in the neighborhood, strategically placed, and the people basically ignored them. And the people felt that they were there, you know, to ride herd on the demonstrators, and there was so many people, and there was such a joyous thing. The people danced around the tanks and waved the pictures to the blue helmeted folks and their machine guns and that. But it turned out that they are actually the ones who came in to minister to the people who were shot, and they were the ones that turned the neighborhood back safe enough from the police. The police, there was a report of a police tank-like truck running down the street. There were the state police who were dressed all in black, and SWAT teams, helmets, ski masks, heavy guns, combat boots, and the like, kicking people, shooting people, and the like. And it was just totally unprovoked. And I was there with Father Gerard Jean-Just, who your listeners know well, and he said on the way back, he said, "You see, Bill, you know, what we face trying to do a nonviolent return of democracy in Haiti." And he said, "The challenges we face are just incredible. We need international support to help us bring back our president, release our political prisoners, and restore constitutional democracy in Haiti." It was a horrifying illustration of the abuses that are going on there right now, back with the government that certainly was selected by the United States.
Bill, who was the journalist who was shot?
I am not sure who that person is, to tell you the truth.
Well, Bill Quigley, I want to thank...
There were people down...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, there were people down in the street, and they were dragging people away. It was mass confusion.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Bill Quigley, joining us from the streets of Port-au-Prince, talking about the latest news out of Haiti, police opening fire on pro-Aristide demonstrators. If you want to go to our website at democracynow.org, you'll see our comprehensive coverage of Haiti, the first going through this year, particularly on the days immediately following the coup. This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, on public access TV stations, as well as PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org, where we have our full archive and have closed captioning for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. As we turn now to our in-depth coverage of the treatment of people arrested, detained, or imprisoned as part of the so-called war on terror, today's story takes us not to Guantanamo Bay or to Abu Ghraib or to the Bagram Air Base. It happened right here in New York at a facility some human rights lawyers are calling Brooklyn's Abu Ghraib. In the days after the World Trade Center attacks, 1,200 Middle Eastern immigrants nationwide were picked up by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, now folded into the Homeland Security Department. At least 84 of these detainees were held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, known as the MDC. Some were detained for months under a so-called hold-until-cleared policy. The policy permitted Muslim and Arab non-citizens to be arrested and held in custody until cleared by the FBI. In 2002, seven plaintiffs filed a class action lawsuit against employees of the MDC and the U.S. government, challenging the constitutionality of this policy. The plaintiffs have also alleged abuse during their time in detention. The New York Daily News ran a major expose on February 20th detailing these allegations, including humiliation, sleep deprivation, physical and sexual abuse. And though the Inspector General at the Justice Department substantiated many of the charges, the department has refused to prosecute any officers at the Metropolitan Detention Center. The Bureau of Prisons did not return our calls when we asked them to comment on the case, and the Justice Department also did not respond to our request for information on their investigation. But we are joined in the studio by Nancy Chang of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the lawyer representing plaintiffs in the suit, and by Larry Kolaresis, the reporter who wrote the article for the New York Daily News. On the phone from Egypt, we have Yasser Ibrahim, one of the plaintiffs in the suit. Larry Kolaresis, let's begin with you. Tell us the story of MDC.
Well, as you said, there were 84 prisoners that were basically swept off the streets of New York and elsewhere in the country. In the days right after 9/11, there was a policy by the Justice Department basically to get any immigrants on any irregularities that they could find on them, responding to reports, tips that they got that people saw that there were immigrants they were suspicious of. If those immigrants had visa violations or any other irregularities in the record, they were basically put into prison. And according to the Justice Department policy, they were held there while the FBI investigated to see if they might have any connection to 9/11. In the case of MDC in Brooklyn, in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, this was the place to which those prisoners were sent that were considered, quote unquote, of high interest. These were people that the Justice Department determined were the people they were most interested in learning about, most suspicious of. And they were put not in a regular prison population, but in what was called the ADMAX SHU, the maximum security isolation jail cells.
Special housing unit.
That's right, special housing unit. In that special housing unit, they could be held anywhere from weeks to many months.
This is solitary?
This was solitary confinement for 23 hours per day. In theory, they were given 1 hour a day of recreation in a kind of limited semi-outdoor space, but as I found out when I interviewed many of them, they were often just thrown out in the middle of the winter into this outdoor space without any clothing except their light cotton prison garb. So many of them chose just to stay in prison 24 hours a day because they didn't feel like freezing. Some of those who did go out for the hour of recreation per day were not allowed back in, sometimes for three. According to Ahmed Khalifa, he stood out 4 hours knocking on the door, freezing, trying to get back in while the guards basically looked from the inside and locked him out. Mm.
How hard is it to get this information?
Well, actually, it's not that hard. It's just not that publicized. The Inspector General of the Justice Department, Glenn Fine, did an initial report in June 2003 looking into allegations of mistreatment of these prisoners. At the time, he learned that there had been a memo put out by the Justice Department ordering videotapes be made of these prisoners, both in their prison cells and whenever they were taken out. He noted in the June 2003 report that he'd asked about these videotapes. He was told they were destroyed, they were lost, they were taped over. A few months later, he got a tip leading him to a room way back in the Metropolitan Detention Center, and there was a stack of 400 of these videotapes just sitting there. He looked at them, found out that many of the accounts that the guards had given him of their treatment of these prisoners were demonstrably untrue. There they were on videotape being beat up. They were chained at their feet, and chained with their hands behind their back, being smashed headfirst into walls. They were being stripped naked with women around. These, I don't say that it's proper for any prisoners, but these were Muslim and Arab prisoners who had a keen sense of the humiliation of that. This was also on videotape, and there were also videotape, at least one videotape of some prisoners with light cotton clothes being kept out in the cold weather during their 1 hour of recreation per day.
Mm-hmm. For listeners and viewers who are joining us now, we're not talking about Abu Ghraib. We're not talking about Guantanamo Bay. We are talking about Brooklyn, New York, the Metropolitan Detention Center there, the MDC. Nancy Chang also with us at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Can you talk about your clients and the lawsuit that you've brought?
Certainly, Amy. What Larry described was horrific, and lives were destroyed. Our clients are seven men, six of whom are Muslim, and one is actually Indian and Hindu, but apparently was mistaken for Muslim, or perhaps had colleagues who were Muslim and was arrested for that reason. And many of them are extremely distraught over what happened to them. They, to this date, some of them are unable to focus enough to hold a job, and their reputations have been ruined. They have been stigmatized. They are seeking the truth in this lawsuit. This lawsuit is called Turkman versus Ashcroft, and they are seeking money damages so that they can continue with their lives. And I could tell you about the suit if
Tell us about the suit in some detail.
Basically, we are alleging that the government suspended its normal rules under the Constitution. It used as a pretext their immigration violations to hold them in detention and sidestepped all the protections that are in place for criminal detainees, which include an arraignment, going probable cause hearings, and the like, right to counsel. And by sidestepping this and holding them in immigration detention and then changing through unpublished rules the immigration detention rules, individuals were held for as long as 8 months and in some cases even longer than that. They were not in any way connected with terrorism. None of these individuals were. They were picked up in the most haphazard manner, and the designation that Larry mentioned, the high interest designation, was quite arbitrary, and before very long the government realized that these individuals were of no interest to their terrorism investigation.
Yasser Ibrahim joins us from Egypt. He was held for 8 months at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy. Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Can you tell us what happened to you? When were you picked up? What happened to you at MDC?
Well, I was picked up on September 30th, 2001. It was me, my brother, and our roommates, which were all Arabs and Muslims. And we've been taken to the immigration building in Varick Street, and we spent the night there, and then the next day they took us to MDC, where we stayed for more than 8 months.
And what happened to you there?
Well, in addition to everything that Larry mentioned and Nancy and what the YG report had mentioned, we went through, like, a nightmare of physical torture and psychological torture. We've been deprived from the slightest rights of human beings. We've been stripped in front of women. We had the worst food you can ever imagine. We've been physically abused, slammed into walls for particularly no reasons at all. And I stayed in solitary confinement for 8.5 months until I was deported. And every time I asked for why I was being treated this way, and they always gave me the same answer, that I was of high interest to the government, or what they used to call me as maximum security, classified as being a maximum security inmate. And then after 8.5 months of this torture, they just took me away and they put me in a plane and sent me back to Egypt.
And charged with anything?
What's that, I'm sorry?
Were you charged with anything?
No, nothing at all. Just immigration violation, because I overstayed my visa. That's it.
You talk about these months in solitary confinement. What does that mean? How do you get by?
In solitary confinement?
Yes.
Well, I find it hard to for your listeners to imagine being in a small room, you know, very small room with very small window on the corridor. Looked on the street, but they blocked this window after two months of our stay there. And you got only the walls to stare at for 8.5 months. And, well, I tried to stay focused, you know, because I knew this was like physical and psychological torture, and I tried to keep my faith. I spend my time reading the Quran and praying and hoping for the day of my release. That's all I can recall now from this experience. You know, I'm trying to forget all the bad experience that I've went through.
Yasser Ibrahim is joining us from Alexandria, Egypt, where he was deported after being held for 8.5 months at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, never charged. Which brings me to a story in the headlines today. Here in the United States, a federal judge ordering that the Bush administration can no longer keep U.S. citizen Jose Padilla in jail if he's not charged with a crime. Padilla has been in prison for more than 2.5 years as a so-called enemy combatant, never been charged with a crime, never appeared in a courtroom challenging his detention. Nancy Chang, what is the significance of this? I mean, this is separate from MDC, but related in one way.
It's very related. The case of Jose Padilla is another instance of the executive branch, the Bush administration, asserting broad powers to detain people, creating brand new rules in the war on terrorism. In this case, the government took the position that it could take any U.S. citizen, toss them into a military brig, and again, keep them outside of the criminal justice system with all of the checks and balances that I had mentioned earlier, right to counsel, probable cause hearings, and the like. The importance of this ruling cannot be understated. It's saying that the government, the executive branch, is not above the Constitution. And this is a critical ruling for all of us stand at risk of arbitrary government detention at this point in time.
In the Washington Post today, it says, rejecting a series of arguments put forward by the government, District Court Judge Henry Floyd said the indefinite detention of Jose Padilla, the administration has said is a terrorist supporter of Al-Qaeda, is illegal and that Padilla must be released from the naval brig in Charleston, South Carolina, within 45 days or charged with a crime. Floyd said to do otherwise would not only offend the rule of law and violate this country's constitutional tradition, but it would also be a betrayal of this nation's commitment to the separation of powers that safeguards our democratic values and our individual liberties. Judge Floyd was appointed by President Bush 2 years ago.
That's right. He also sits in the Fourth Circuit, the most conservative circuit in the country, and that is where the case will go next. The Fourth Circuit will hear this on the government's appeal.
I want to end by asking Larry Kolaresis, what most shocked you in doing this series? And are you still waiting to get information under the Freedom of Information Act? What is classified? What isn't?
There was a lot of shocking things, such as doing frequent strippings, strip searches, endless strip searches, sometimes up to six a day, objects being put up the rectums of the people being strip searched. But the funny thing is, the thing that shocked me the most was not that, but learning that the criminal investigation of these activities came to a halt because the Justice Department claimed they could not pursue the investigation since they had deported all the inmates. That brought me up short. It reminded me of the old Yiddish joke of the child who murders his parents and then throws himself at the mercy of the judge because he's an orphan. They did not pursue video depositions. They did not pursue closed-circuit TV depositions or even a special visa that exists that could bring people back here temporarily to testify. All of the witnesses, all of the ex-inmates I talked to were ready to come back to testify. Supposedly there are still investigations going on now, but not one of the 12 people I interviewed had ever been approached for testimony.
Now, we are not only talking about Arab Muslims who have been the hardest hit in this country after 9/11 in this MDC detention, as Nancy mentioned also. A man from India, and you report on Israeli Jews who were arrested as well.
Five Israeli Jews were among those sort of swept off the street in the frantic mania after 9/11. They had been working for a moving company without a work visa out in New Jersey. Somebody had seen, quote unquote, individuals of Middle Eastern appearance standing on the roof of this New Jersey moving company with a view of the World Trade Center. They saw the attack. They got their video cameras out. They felt that they were in the presence of something amazing, terrible, and they filmed it. Whoever saw this reported to the police that they seemed to be very excited and very enthusiastic. Later in the day, after this report came in, they were stopped while driving in a van on the New Jersey Turnpike. And just to give you an idea of how logical the process of sorting out these prisoners were, they were considered prisoners of high interest, the most suspicious prisoners, and put into maximum security detention at the Metropolitan Detention Center.
For how long?
They were there for, I think, 4 months. And during that time, they underwent torture and abuse, just like all the others.
Yasser Ibrahim, from Alexandria now in Egypt. Your final words as we wrap up this segment.
Well, I think I mentioned this before, but as I said, it's still I cannot believe that what happened to me happened on American soil.
We will leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, Larry Kohler-Essis. Thank you as well of the New York Daily News for this very important report, and Nancy Chang of the Center for Constitutional Rights. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at what two whistleblowers are saying about their private military contractor, Custer Battles. Stay with us.
Which will you go for? Which will you love? Which will you choose from? From the stars above? Which will you answer? Which will you call? Which will you take for your one and all? Tell me now, which will you love best? Which do you dance for? Which makes you shine?
Which will? Nick Drake here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S. military contractor in Iraq is at the center of a controversy over how American forces dispersed and accounted for hundreds of millions of dollars in Iraq. The firm is Custer Battles. It's being charged in a lawsuit of defrauding the Coalition Provisional Authority of tens of millions of dollars during work in Iraq, which included securing Baghdad International Airport. Two former employees sued the company last year under the False Claims Act, seeking to recover damages on behalf of the U.S. government. They allege that Custer Battles repeatedly billed the occupation authorities for non-existent services or at grossly inflated prices. A few months after they filed the suit, the Justice Department declined to intervene on the whistleblower's behalf. Because the case is the first to be unsealed involving the charges of fraud and the multi-billion dollar Iraqi reconstruction effort, it could set precedents. We're joined now by the attorney in the case, Alan Grayson, and in our studio by Prothap Chatterjee, independent reporter, managing editor of CorpWatch.org, and author of the book Iraq, Inc. Let's go first to Alan Grayson on the phone, who's representing the two former employees. What is Custer Battles? First of all, start with a name.
Well, Custer Battles was founded by two former Army officers, Custer and Battles. Those are the names of the individuals who formed the organization. Custer was someone who tried to drum up mercenary work in Afghanistan when the occupation of Afghanistan began, and he was notably unsuccessful. Battles is someone who ran for Congress against the Kennedy in 2002, also notably unsuccessful, but in the course of doing so, he made some very powerful friends, and his leading, largest contributor was, in fact, Haley Barbour, the head of the Republican National Committee.
Can you talk about what the former employees are charging?
Certainly. The allegations are that this company committed any kind of fraud that they could imagine over the course of working for the Coalition Provisional Authority and as subcontractors under U.S. contracts. For instance, they set up Cayman Islands subsidiaries and subsidiaries of subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands, and then they manufactured out of thin air invoices from these subsidiaries and handed them in under their time and materials contracts, which basically operated like expense accounts. And they handed in these vouchers that they had created themselves, said that they were from their independent companies, which were in fact subsidiaries, and they received millions and millions of dollars in reimbursement from the government.
Prothap Chatterjee, you have been investigating this as well for CorpWatch.org. Talk more about the defrauding that is being alleged.
Well, there's some very stark examples. An example of a $95,000 helicopter pad that they were supposed to build in Mosul, Iraq. And they built $157,000 for it. And Mike Battles himself actually absentmindedly left a piece of paper detailing how $3.74 million in what he had spent had been billed to the U.S. government for $9.8 million. So, you know, markups of 162%. So this is what we as taxpayers had to pay for these services. And basically, what's most interesting, I think, about this case is not simply that they had these companies. There was a company called Secure Global Distribution and another one called Middle East Leasing in the Cayman Islands, is that everybody in Iraq does the same thing. Halliburton has a subsidiary called Service Employees International. If you work for Halliburton of Houston, your contract is signed with a company in the Cayman Islands, and it's a tax dodge. We suspect, given that 59 out of 100 top federal military contractors have these offshore subsidiaries, is that everybody is using this way to be able to pump up charges.
And Cayman Islands, that has to do with taxes as well?
Absolutely, because you know it's an offshore tax subsidiary. Offshore tax haven. And so people place subsidiaries there in order to be able to zero their taxes out.
Talk about how this case is going and what Custer Battles is alleging in terms of money coming from the CPA, ironically named, the Coalition Provisional Authority, and what the U.S. government is saying about it all.
Well, basically, Custer Battles, and maybe Alan can even explain it, although this is the case made by the company, so maybe I'll represent the company for a moment, if I may, Alan, and then you can tell me what's wrong with this. But Custer Battles is saying, well, the False Claims Act, it does not apply. The U.S. government has no jurisdiction over this money because, A, this is Iraqi money, and B, the CPA, didn't even really exist. And therefore, it is not a legitimate U.S. agency that should be giving out this money. And so, in fact, I think Judge Ellis has asked the U.S. government to tell him whether or not this agency existed. And there's some dispute. The Congressional Research Service, there's a woman by the name of Elaine Halchin, who's an expert there, who has been unable to decide whether or not the CPA, whether Paul Bremer's organization actually existed. It does not appear to have been created under 1483, the resolution of the United Nations Security Council, or I can't remember the Security Council of the General Assembly, on May 22nd, 2003. Or if it was created by this this thing called a national presidential, I forget what it's called exactly. It's a special directive of the president. It's a national security presidential directive. However, this is a presidential directive that's never been published, so we don't know. And Alan, in fact, aren't you waiting to hear as to whether from the federal government as to whether or not the CPA even existed?
Well, in fact, though, the one thing the federal government has agreed to do grudgingly in our case is to file a brief on April 1st, April Fool's Day, about whether, in fact, the False Claims Act applies to CPA-type contracts. But in our mind, it's not a realistic argument the defendants are making here. This company was doing security work in a war zone under U.S. military supervision. In fact, they were doing the same kind of work that the U.S. military was doing in the same place at the same time. They were paid entirely with U.S. Treasury funds. The first $4 million they received was in cash, in bricks of $100,000, that's $1,100 bills, that came directly from the U.S. Mint. And after that, they were paid with U.S. Treasury checks with the Statue of Liberty on them and with wire transfers from Federal Reserve accounts in New York that were U.S. Treasury accounts.
Now, Alan Grayson, why isn't the U.S. government helping in this? I mean, it's about getting money back. It's about fraud against the U.S. government.
Well, there's no good explanation. There's no good answer to that question. In fact, the U.S. government should be helping, and they're not. The Bush administration has done nothing up to this point to get this money back. In fact, it was almost a year before they even cut off the flow of new contracts to this contractor. And to this day, Custer Battles is still performing security work in Iraq. In fact, they're responsible for the security involved in the training of the Iraqi army personnel right now. In fact, this corrupt contractor, who the government knew on October 18th of 2003 had already stolen $6 million from the government, right to this day, the U.S. government is still stuffing money in their pockets.
Prothap Chatterjee.
Amy, it's amazing. There's an employee of Custer Battles who took $12 million in cash of the company, put it on a plane, I kid you not, it's called the Flying Carpet, and took it to Beirut for safekeeping. So we're talking, we have pictures, you know, of and testimony from the people who paid them at the CPA. There's a man by the name of Frank Willis, worked for the U.S. government, for the Coalition Provisional Authority, really. And he had provided us with a picture of $2 million in cash that he was handing over. He said there was so much money, they were playing football with it.
Now, Frank Willis just testified, right, in Congress 2 weeks ago.
Indeed, he did, with Alan Grayson at the Democratic Policy Committee of the Senate.
So what is this going to come to now? The U.S. government has been putting off saying whether, in fact, the Coalition Provisional Authority that they set up exists at all. Is this one of the stumbling blocks right now, Alan Grayson?
Well, in fact, you have to understand how reluctant the government has been to do this. It's only as a result of the hearing, as a result of the fact that Senator Grassley, a Republican, the number three Republican in the Senate, sent a letter to the Attorney General saying, what the heck is going on here? And a result of 325 newspaper articles that followed from the hearing, and perhaps the result of the fact that four former Custer Battles employees were featured on NBC the day after the hearing, and one of them is quoted as saying, I don't want any part of an organization that deliberately murders children and innocent civilians. As a result of all of that, on the last possible day that they could do so, the government grudgingly agreed to submit a brief to the court explaining not why this money could be recovered, but whether it could be recovered, and doing so on the last possible day, April 1st.
Let me underline actually again what Alan said about the NBC report. Four soldiers testified that Custer Battles employees were going out in tanks and deliberately targeting U.S. civilians, and not only that,
U.S. civilians,
but Iraqi civilians, and not only that, Alan's clients are now being threatened, have death threats against them.
We have to leave it there. Prothap Chatterjee, Alan Grayson, thanks for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope Dokadus, John Hamilton, and Nagara Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'll see folks in Ann Arbor on March 10th. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.